Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Insurrection aftermath. Republican senators block an independent investigation into the mob attack on the Capitol on January 6th. Then mega drought. The western U.S. faces a critical shortage of water as the threats of wildfires loom on the horizon.
No, this drought is far from over. 2021 is shaping up to potentially be the driest of all of the drought years in the last century, and definitely one of the driest of the last millennium.
And it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart analyze the failure to investigate the insurrection and President Biden's $6 trillion change-making federal budget proposal. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. At the site of a deadly riot, Republican senators block an investigation into the attack on January 6th. The push to create a commission like the one established after 9/11 failed today after GOP leadership used special delaying tactics for the first time this year. Lisa Desjardins is here to explain what happened. Hello, Lisa. I know you were following this well into the night as we waited for a vote. Tell us, how close did the Senate come to seeing this commission voted into existence?
For this divided Senate, this was close. The commission came within three votes of getting the 60 Senate votes in support that it would need. Now, that is adding in some absent senators, because as you say, it was a late night, and about a dozen senators actually left Washington before this vote because they thought it was a fait accompli. But all in all, let's look at the Republicans who supported moving on to this bill, kind of overriding that filibuster block. There were six Republican senators. There you seven Republican senators, rather. You see them all right there, who either voted today in favor of moving forward with the commission or who said they would have voted in favor. And I want to stress, of those seven, six of them were also senators who voted to convict President Trump in the last impeachment trial, which was, of course, related to January 6th. Senator Lisa Murkowski, one of those yes votes, told reporters last night that indeed she did feel that there was a Trump factor. To her words, she said some Republicans simply didn't want to rock the boat. Democrats were furious. But of course, 57 votes, that's a majority of the Senate. What does that mean for the filibuster? Well, there was no effort by Democrats to try and break the filibuster over this issue while there was outrage.
And Lisa, you've been following not just this, but also the dynamics around what led to January 6th in the first place. What are you finding? What is your reporting telling you?
Right. Our team has been carefully watching all around the country to what's happening, and something really caught our attention last night in Dalton, Georgia. As Republican senators here in Washington, most of them were preparing to block the January 6th independent commission. In Dalton, Georgia, Representative Matt Gaetz, Republican of Florida, gave remarks to a crowd in a sort of an America First kind of pro-Trump rally about the Second Amendment. And I want to play his remarks here.
It's not about hunting. It's not about recreation. It's not about sports. The Second Amendment is about maintaining within the citizenry the ability to maintain an armed rebellion against the government if that becomes necessary. I hope it never does.
There you heard, it's about maintaining an armed insurrection. He said he doesn't hope that it comes to pass. But this is different than traditional conservative thought about protecting liberty, individuals' homes. This is an obvious statement about making government itself the enemy. I should note, of course, that Representative Gaetz is under investigation, federal investigation, for accusations involving prostitution and corruption that he denies. But we wanted to highlight this clip because the crowd's reaction and Representative Gaetz pointedly talking about government as the potential enemy.
Lisa Desjardins reporting on both of these angles of what has been happening at the Capitol. Lisa, thank you. And we should add that late today, Gladys Sicknick, who is the mother of fallen Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick, spoke to CNN about her reaction to today's vote and her tense meetings with lawmakers.
They knew what they were doing. They knew how to talk to us. And but we kind of held back, and it was tense.
It was just tense because
we knew, I think because we knew they weren't sincere. They weren't sincere.
And they didn't want to get to the bottom of what happened.
No, no. And I don't understand it.
We will continue our look at Republicans blocking the January 6th commission later in the program. In the day's other news, President Biden formally released his $6 trillion budget proposal for the new fiscal year. The plan would sharply increase federal spending on infrastructure, public health, and education. It would be funded largely by tax increases on corporations and wealthy Americans. Even so, it forecasts a deficit of nearly $2 trillion, sending overall national debt to new highs. On the pandemic, the CDC says tonight that fully vaccinated children do not have to wear masks at camp this summer. It also says that children not yet vaccinated should use masks in crowds or when they are inside. The new guidance has been much anticipated by parents. With COVID restrictions easing, Americans are traveling in near record numbers this Memorial Day weekend. Today, the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, warned of long lines at airports with traffic hitting pre-pandemic levels.
People will see lines because there's going to be a tremendous amount of people traveling this weekend. But patience is required. This is a partnership between TSA and the people we serve.
Mayorkas also said that officials are considering possible vaccine passports for people going abroad. Later, however, his agency said there are no such current plans. The issue has become a flashpoint for opponents who say the passports would violate personal freedoms. Also today, the World Health Organization said that it's formulating a plan for more studies on the origins of COVID-19. Overnight, the U.S. criticized the initial study as, quote, insufficient and inconclusive. That report found it was extremely unlikely that the virus escaped from a Chinese lab. A new cyber attack has hit more than 150 U.S. and foreign government agencies, think tanks, and humanitarian groups. Microsoft says that the culprits are the same Russians behind the SolarWinds hack. This time, they accessed an email service used by the U.S. Agency for International Development and then targeted 3,000 other accounts. Vice President Kamala Harris told graduates at the U.S. Naval Academy today that they will face challenges unlike anything that came before. She spoke to about 1,000 graduating midshipmen in Annapolis, Maryland, the first woman to do so in the school's 175 years. And she warned it's a new era.
Adversaries have their sights set on our military technology, our intellectual property, our elections, our critical infrastructure. The ransomware attack by criminal hackers earlier this month, well, that was a warning shot.
Last year, the Academy held its first virtual graduation due to the pandemic. Three police officers in Tacoma, Washington, pled not guilty today to killing a black man, Manuel Ellis, in March of 2020. Two white officers are charged with second-degree murder. An Asian-American officer is accused of manslaughter. Prosecutors say he held Ellis down until he suffocated. Organizers in Oklahoma have canceled Monday's main event commemorating the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921. They cite unexpected circumstances. U.S. Homeland Security officials had issued general guidance about possible attacks at such events. The massacre involved a white mob's killing some 300 people, most of them black. In economic news, the Postal Service is asking to raise first-class stamp prices by 3 cents to 58 cents. It's part of a general increase filed with the Postal Regulatory Commission. And on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 64 points to close at 34,529. The Nasdaq rose 12 points. The S&P 500 added 3. And the investigation continues tonight in the rail yard shooting that killed 9 people in San Jose, California. The motive remains unclear, but officials have identified the victims. Stephanie Tsai has a remembrance.
36-year-old Tatej Deep Singh spent his final moments trying to keep others safe, his family said. A husband and father to two, Tatej Deep was committed to serving others. Michael Rudametkin started at VTA as a mechanic before becoming an overhead line worker. The 40-year-old was described on Facebook as a great friend. Jose Hernandez III lived life with zest, his family told the Associated Press. He was described by his father as a man with many friends. Jose was 35. Alex Fritsch was described as optimistic, passionate, and a dreamer, a husband and father to two teenage boys. Alex, who worked at a substation, was 49 years old. Paul Mejia was an assistant superintendent at VTA and always willing to help employees and accept tasks with a smile, his colleague said. Paul was 42 years old. Timothy Romo was described as caring and selfless, and he had endless jokes. The 49-year-old husband, father, and grandfather worked at VTA for more than two decades. Lars Lane was the first to help his neighbor, and he loved his family fiercely, his son said. According to local news outlets, Lars would have turned 64 this weekend. Abdulvehab Alagmandan worked for VTA for two decades. He often worked overtime and throughout the pandemic. He was 63 years old. Adrian Baeza was a light rail operator at VTA. He was a loving family man who still had so much to give, his family said. Adrian was 29 years old.
Such an enormous loss. And still to come on the NewsHour, why the mega drought is dangerous for the Western U.S., how QAnon is dividing families, art inspired by the Tulsa massacre 100 years later, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
We return now to our lead story. Today's move by the GOP to block an investigation into the Capitol insurrection. Former New Jersey Governor Tom Kaine, a Republican himself, was chairman of the independent bipartisan 9/11 Commission. That was a congressionally approved panel which served as a model for the proposed January 6th Commission. And Governor Kaine joins me now. Governor Kaine, so good to see you, and thank you for joining us. What is your reaction to this vote today where the proposal to create a commission fell short by a number of votes?
I'm sad. I mean, it looks to me right now like American people may never find out the truth. And we need to know the truth. We got to find out why this happened, how it happened, why the Capitol wasn't defended the way it was, who was involved in the conspiracies, and we need to do that to prevent it ever happening again.
Governor Kaine, what about the argument made by a number of Republican senators who, there were six of them voted for, but the vast majority voted against. But a number of them said, well, there are already investigations underway. Congress has various committees looking into this, that a commission, an independent commission, wasn't needed.
Well, it's the same thing they said when they tried to prevent the 9/11 Commission from being created. The truth is Congress cannot properly investigate this kind of a thing unless you have a structure, a bipartisan structure, and one that enables you to have a staff to find out the truth. Congress is very busy doing a whole bunch of things that are extraordinarily partisan, and something, this is too important for the American, for America's history. We got to get this right. And I'm afraid now, unless they change their minds, they're not going to get it right.
I was also reading a comment from Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee. He predicted, he said that this, if it had been created, would have been what he called a kangaroo commission. It would have been looking at areas outside January the 6th, and it constituted a recipe for a witch hunt. Did you see any potential for that in what was being suggested?
None that I saw. And that's, you know, Congress should have a clear description of what this commission should do, and I think it did in the legislation. And I didn't see any chance of witch hunt at all. I think they would have done a good job. There are good men and women in both parties who are willing to give government service and would have done it to find the truth this time. So, and the truth is what we really need in a democracy so we can proceed.
And Governor, this is what you're referring to, I know, in the comments you're making. But help our audience understand what's lost by not having an outside, independent, bipartisan body to look into the events of the attack on the Capitol?
Credibility is what's lost. Because right now, if you have a congressional investigation now, and we've seen a lot of them now, you get Republicans yelling at Democrats, Democrats yelling at Republican, and the truth gets lost. What we're asking for in this was a bipartisan investigation with good people who are retired from the Congress, probably, or retired from public service, who could look at it impartially, openly, and make a report to the American people that would have been accepted as truth. That's the model of the 9/11 Commission. The 9/11 Commission worked. We found out the truth, and we acted in the truth. We made recommendations, and due to those recommendations, this country has never been attacked again in the same way.
And Governor Kate, I mentioned, of course, you are Republican. You served two terms as governor of the state of New Jersey. How do you explain the fact that so many members of your party are opposed to the idea of investigating what happened?
Well, I think they're worried. They're probably worried about what would come out. But the truth never hurts you in the end. The truth is what you need in a democracy. And so I think they're making a mistake. And they did the same thing about the 9/11 Commission. They opposed it for the same reasons. And it got through because the families of 9/11 pushed it through the Congress. We need that kind of a push now because, you know, we got to find out what happened so we can proceed and go ahead.
And we know it was not just former President Trump who made it very clear he opposed the idea of this commission, but the Senate Republican leader, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, worked very hard to persuade other Republican senators to vote against this. What is your message to him?
Well, what we learned in the 9/11 Commission was Republicans were very worried, as were Democrats, we'd find out things about then-President Bush, and it would hurt him for re-election. In fact, we found out the former president was telling the truth. It probably helped him in his re-election. You don't suffer if you find out the truth. And the only way, unfortunately, in this very divided country of ours, in this very divided Congress right now, to find out the truth is to do it in this manner, do it in a bipartisan manner, and one that everybody accepts. And unfortunately, that looks like it's not going to happen.
And speaking of that, I mean, now that we've had this vote, is there a way that you know of where there could be some kind of independent investigation short of what Congress was trying to create?
Well, you can do it outside of Congress, but then you don't have subpoena power. You don't have the tools you need in order to do a proper investigation. So this is the right way to do it. And my hope is that the public and other people will call and the people in both parties to say, look, let's do it. Let's do it right. And tell the American people what they have to know to go forward.
Governor, have you been in contact with members of Congress, with members of the Senate on this to make the kinds of arguments you're sharing with us?
I have not. I probably should have. I've said a number of things publicly, and I've talked to a few congressmen, but I have not talked to members of the Senate.
And based on what you're seeing right now, do you see hope? I know you talk to people in public life all the time. Do you see prospects for creating something that could in some way get to the bottom of what happened on January 6th?
It looks very discouraging at the time we're talking, and it's not only discouraging for this. If Congress has now decided that they have an inability to appoint an independent commission to look at one of the country's most serious problems, that's a very bad sign for the future. Because if they can't do this properly, they're not going to be able to do the next one properly either. This just sets a precedent. That's the wrong precedent. It's that Congress is incapable of telling the American people the truth about something very important that happened. And that's wrong.
The former governor of the state of New Jersey and the former chair of the 9/11 Commission, Tom Kaine. Thank you very much, Governor Kaine. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Nearly one half of the country, from the Pacific Coast to the Great Plains and the Upper Midwest, is experiencing moderate to exceptional drought conditions. It's expected to get worse through the summer. But as William Brangham reports, it's the western states in particular that are taking the hardest hit.
Across the American West, there simply isn't enough water to go around, and the full heat of summer is just getting started. From the Rio Grande to the Rocky Mountains, a mega drought is underway. It's shaping up to be the worst water crisis in generations. The darker the red, the worse it is. Reservoirs that store water for millions are below normal and are projected to hit historic lows soon. This month, California's governor, Democrat Gavin Newsom, expanded drought state of emergencies to 41 of his state's 58 counties, affecting one-third of the state.
Let me just state unequivocally, guys, it's really bad.
In Utah, Republican Governor Spencer Cox declared a statewide drought emergency and has asked all residents to conserve water. Lake Mead, which is created by the Hoover Dam, is the largest reservoir in America, and it's getting so low, it could trigger a first-ever federal shortage declaration, which could limit water for millions. For those who've been studying climate change in the West, this has been brewing for years.
Since the year 2000, the western United States and northern Mexico has been in near perpetual drought.
Park Williams is a climate scientist at UCLA. By studying ancient tree rings, he's able to compare today's climate and drought conditions to those of the past.
While there have been droughts that were longer than this one in the past, you've got to go back hundreds of years to find one. This drought, which is now 22 years old, is just as severe as the driest 22-year periods in any of those historic mega droughts.
And this one's not over, as far as we could tell.
No, this drought is far from over. 2021 is shaping up to potentially be the driest of all of the drought years in the last century, and definitely one of the driest of the last millennium.
This intense dryness is endangering fisheries and wildlife, while farmers across the West are facing crop failures and cattle losses.
When you're talking about compounding multiple years of drought, it becomes very, very difficult.
Kevin Richards is a fourth-generation farmer in Central Oregon.
If you don't have the water to plant a new crop, then you're starting off one step behind next year. So even if the drought were to recover, if we don't have new crops in the ground that need planted in the fall, then it's really going to take an entire 12 more months to recover.
And there is, unfortunately, no relief in sight. Much of this year's winter snowpack was well below normal. For example, in California, where snowmelt delivers roughly three-quarters of the state's water, snow cover is the lowest it's been in the 21 years that NASA satellites have been monitoring it. All of this parched land increases the likelihood of another deadly, destructive, and extended fire season. California has already seen 900 additional wildfires this season, compared to this point in 2020, which itself was a record year. And this is a region-wide concern. From last spring to this winter, Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, and Utah each had their driest stretch in 126 years.
For the farmers that grow hay, if they do have hay, they're in a good position because the price is high.
Dustin Cox is a farmer and cattle rancher in Utah.
We're getting into the point of, okay, do you feed cows $250 a ton hay, or do you sell the cows? If you sell the cows, you're not going to get very much right now, because if all the ranchers sell cows, then there's a big supply of cattle. There's not a big demand, because no one in the West, it's not like it's just regional, right? It's all over. It's all over the West.
Drought conditions are also causing problems for Native American communities, like the Yurok tribe, which lives along the Klamath River in Northern California.
Drought puts our natural resources and way of life at risk.
At a virtual hearing this week, Yurok Representative Amy Cordalis told Congress that drought, as well as restrictions on water flows by the government, had harmed the salmon, which are central to her tribe's traditions and economy.
Historically, the Klamath River was the third largest salmon-producing river on the West Coast. Tragically, it's estimated only 2 to 5% of the salmon runs remain today, and we have lost millions of dollars as a result.
And the impact of this drought could ripple out to consumers nationwide, a huge percentage of the nation's fruits and vegetables, nuts and beef come out of this increasingly arid West.
It's going to take more good luck to pull ourselves out of this drought and less bad luck to fall back into the drought. The long-term normal is changing in Western North America toward a drying one.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
A survey released by the Public Religion Research Institute this week found 15% of Americans believe the false QAnon idea that the government is controlled by a cabal of Satan-worshipping pedophiles. And just 1 in 5 Republicans fully reject the QAnon conspiracy theory. For many Americans, those ideas are not only outlandish, they are dangerous and are tearing their families apart. We spoke with 3 people whose relationships have been hurt by these far-right, unfounded beliefs.
Hi, my name's Rachel, and my relationship with my mother has become completely estranged in the last year.
My parents have fallen down the QAnon rabbit hole and have become extremely obsessed with it.
I have a sister who believes in the QAnon conspiracy theory. She's watching YouTube videos, and she's just getting funneled down that algorithm, right? Like, to more and more kind of radical, bizarre things.
My dad was my best friend growing up. We did everything together. And then in just the past year, for sure, he's just changed into a different person.
My sister has always been my best friend. And she is to this day. I love her. It's hard to explain sister love. I love her in a way that I can't love anybody else. And I worry about her.
Right before the pandemic year was the closest we ever were. We would go on walks. She would come over and play with the kids. Sorry. It's easier to feel angry at her than it is to start thinking about how much I miss her. I've always been really proud of my mom. She's a nurse. She's a cancer nurse. She's helped a lot of people and their families kind of face difficult moments and face death. She's a kind, loving person, and I feel like she's been tricked into believing all of these things that contradict her core values in a way that is so obvious to me.
What QAnon is doing is they're trying to make the entire world a conspiracy, literally. They will connect the dots to everything that you touch, see, feel, whatever. And that is where the danger zone. That's when I started to be fearful for her. These people believe that you can't take the COVID vaccine because it's going to track you. Well, that's very dangerous for people to be believing that, because they're putting themselves at risk, but they're also putting more other people at risk. They're putting people at risk that they love.
It's not just like a funny conspiracy theory that unicorns and Bigfoot is real and all of like aliens and all these things. It's these, they've almost indoctrinated them. And they're like set in his core beliefs. It's exactly like a cult, you know, and they like drink the Kool-Aid, and it's really scary.
What happened in my relationship with my mother is that now I'm part of that. I'm part of this, you know, evil force that she has to reckon with. She doesn't trust me. She doesn't believe that I could sympathize with her or that I respect her. You know, a big mistake I made is that, you know, I think she's stupid. There's a lot that, like, if I could go back and correct, like, what I could take responsibility for, it's that I wish I had gotten less frustrated. I wish that I had been more patient. I wish that I had been slower to react.
I thought that if I pointed out, you know, all of this stuff, that, Dad, look at all these websites that prove otherwise. It came back into my face. And I think I'm at the point now where I've given up.
I pray for her every day that she will come to a realization that this is nonsense. I can't do much more than that, because if I discuss it with her, it's only going to break us apart.
I can't change him. I can't force him to do things. I just have to sit here and wait and hope for one day he calls me, texts me, shows up on my door and was just like, yep, I was wrong. And then we go from there. But I hate that I have to wait, but it's for my dad, so I'll do it.
Those are voices we've heard from just in the last number of weeks. And we turn from that to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, columnist for The Washington Post. Very good to see you both. Thank you for being here on this Friday night. And Jonathan, we are sharing those voices because we know that that's part of what was driving the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th. It came to a vote today in the Congress, in the Senate, as you know, and Republicans blocked it. What does that say about not just the Republican Party, but what are the consequences of what happened today?
Yeah, the vote today, Judy, was just shameful. This should not have been a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. This should not have been a partisan vote. This should have been a vote just grounded in patriotism, being able to say with a unified voice that what happened there on January 6th, when they were trying to certify the Electoral College vote in a presidential election, that what happened there was something that needed to be investigated, and if necessary, people held accountable, and lessons learned so that it doesn't happen again. It says a lot about the Republican Party. But to me, I worry what that message sends to the country about how Congress is functioning or not functioning, but also whether the Capitol could withstand another attack. I mean, January 6th wasn't the end of something. It was either the beginning of something or we're in the middle of something. And, you know, even though the Independent Commission failed, that doesn't mean that investigations aren't going on. And I'm not just talking about the court cases that are happening, but, you know, Speaker Pelosi could form a House Select Committee. There are committees in the House and the Senate that are and can do their own investigations. The only problem with that, though, is it would have a partisan tinge just from appearances. But I would argue that any investigation into what happened on January 6th, I believe, would be done for the sole purpose of not partisan, not through partisan lens, but through a patriotic lens of trying to figure out what happened so it doesn't happen again.
And David, what's your thinking as you look at the vote today and, frankly, listening to these family members of people who believe in the QAnon conspiracy?
Well, you know, every party or an organization has loyalty mechanisms, and mostly it's, you know, we commit to something together. The Republican Party as a loyalty mechanism is that you have to believe in the myth. You have to believe in the lie about the election, and you have to believe in the lie about the insurrection. I saw a YouGov poll today that 74% of Republicans think leftist activists were a large part of what caused that. So you have to believe in the myth. And if you're a senator, you have to believe in the myth to stay part of the party. And that's the way it is. Now, I have to imagine that Mitch McConnell and normal Republicans would love to get rid of this myth and would love to get rid of the Trumpian craziness. And it seems to me, and for the benefit of the party and for the benefit of the country, this commission is a way to expose the truth and to begin the detoxification process. Now, sure, your party takes a short-term hit. There'd be bad headlines. But the long-range health of the party, it's got to be a good thing to get to the truth and expose what happened. The final depressing thing to me was 9/11 happened. It was a national blow. And we were at least able to come together around a centrist groups of establishmentarians, trusted individuals, and form a commission. We are no longer that country. And so if we're hit by another blow of whatever sort, will we ever have a commission again? Do we have a center in this country? Do we have a group of people who are trusted on both sides? I'm not sure we live in that country anymore.
Yeah. And Jonathan, it does raise questions about not just who we are as a country, but about what's happened to our political parties and their entire belief systems. But I want to, speaking of belief systems, I want to turn to President Biden, who today proposed his really shockingly large budget proposal, $6 trillion. It really is a bringing together of all of his recent proposals on infrastructure, families, and so forth for the last several weeks. But it is a number we haven't seen before. Is it realistic? Does it meet the needs of the country?
I do think it meets the needs of the country in terms of this. Speaker Pelosi, if you ever interview her about, you know, budgets and things like that, she will tell you, show me your budget and I will show you your values. And I think what President Biden has done with this budget is he is showing the nation what his values are, what his priorities are, and what they are on behalf of the country. Remember, in his joint session speech, he talked about and ground a lot of what he was saying in, you know, we must do this as a nation to repair the nation's roads and bridges, to expand opportunity for Americans by, for instance, expanding broadband access, because that, for the 21st century, is what the national highway system was in the 20th century, all as a means of improving the country so that we can compete against China. And that we are in this battle right now between autocracy and democracy. And the only way that we can prove that democracy is better is that if we can show that democracy works. $6 trillion, Judy, yes, it's a huge price tag. But as we know from President Biden, he sees this as a moment to do big things, to help as many people as possible. And that requires some cold, hard cash in volumes that we have not seen before.
And David, what's your cold, hard assessment of this budget plan?
My warm, mushy assessment is that it's probably necessary. I've never been a progressive or any even close to that. But it is just simply a fact that over the last 30 years, folks with a high school education and associate's degree have not been reaping the benefits of our economy. And President Biden wants to make an investment in those folks. And I think that's just. I was struck by how often he brags about the fact that the infrastructure bill, the benefits, the jobs, they go to people with an associate's degree and a high school degree. The folks who have a college degree don't need as much help, frankly. And so this redirects money to those who need it. So I take the direction to be in the right. The two cautionary warnings, I would say, is first, the threat of inflation is real. This is not just notional. It's not just Warren Buffett warning about this and other business people. The consumer price index is up, and maybe this is just a hiccup, and these are temporary inflationary effects. But if we overheat the economy and wind up with inflation, then the Fed has to slam on the brakes, and the very people who need the help most will suffer most. And so that is something real to look at. And it's just a fact. I just hate it when we get rid of truisms. And it has been a truism that if your debt passes 100% of GDP, your nation is going to be in trouble. And to pretend that law no longer exists worries me. And so I'm worried about the inflation and the debt, but I do think the investment is necessary.
David, just quickly, are you saying because of the inflation worry, the budget is less needed?
No, I'm saying if we've thrown trillions of dollars into the economy, and that's heated up the economy to a great degree, and if we throw another bunch of trillions in, as the budget envisions, then we're really heating up the economy and possibly overheating the economy, which leads to inflation, which leads to lower living standards, which leads to huge government payments on the debt that we owe, and it leads to the 1970s, which was all sorts of bad things.
Lots of warnings in that. Jonathan, I want to, in the final minutes we have, I want to turn to something that we observed this week, and of course that was the 1 year since the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis at the hands of a white policeman. What do you see that our country, about our country over the past year? Have we come to terms in any way, do you think, with what was shown by the death of George Floyd?
It depends on my mood, Judy. On the one hand, yes, we have come to terms in the sense that we are now talking more openly and a little more honestly about racism, structural racism, and the inequities that are built into our system, and how Black and Brown people, but African Americans in particular, bear the brunt of that. I take that as a good sign that we are able to talk about it more freely and more openly. Where things have not changed is in the other shootings that have happened, the other incidences of law enforcement killing Black people You've got the situation of Ronald Green, who was killed 2 years ago, but the video has just come out where the police said one thing and the video shows something horrifically different. Or during the Derek Chauvin trial for the murder of George Floyd, right when we were all waiting for the verdict, what happened? Dante Wright was shot and killed by a Brooklyn Center, Minnesota police officer who was just up the road a bit from the courthouse in Minneapolis. Again, another unarmed African-American man killed by police. While we have incremental progress in some areas, we are reminded sometimes daily that the work, the hard work of changing and whittling away and chiseling away at systemic racism, it is a tough job, it is a hard job, it is but it is a task that is necessary and requires persistence.
And it keeps happening. And David, I'm sorry, only about 30 seconds for you.
Yeah, I think the big thing that's changed for the good is what you might call the mainstreaming of systemic racism. A lot of people used to think racism was a bad person hating African Americans. But I think we understand if you take a look, for example, at the wealth gap between blacks and whites, that's not about just individuals hating. That's something that's been built into the structure of our society through discrimination, through redlining, and all the rest. And so the president, Joe Biden, became the first president to use the term systemic racism. And to me, that's a step forward, because it's not about blaming people. It's about recognizing the legacy of the past and the way it continues to apply injustices in the present. And that mainstreaming of that recognition strikes me at least one step of progress.
It's a conversation we're going to continue to have in the days and weeks and months and years to come. David Brooks, Jonathan Capehart, thank you both.
Thanks, Judy.
Thank you, Judy.
While new coronavirus cases continue to drop in the U.S., the immense toll of the virus remains a constant for so many families who've lost loved ones during this pandemic. We pause to remember some of their stories. Cao Li Eileen Herr was a trailblazer dedicated to helping new immigrants and Asian Americans gain access to resources she never had as a young refugee in the 1970s. Known as Eileen to family and friends, she fled war in Laos to a small town in Iowa at the age of 7, helped to raise her 4 younger siblings while their parents worked long factory hours, and went on to become the first Hmong woman admitted to the Minnesota Bar Association. Empowering young Asian American women was a special focus of Eileen's. She leaves behind a series of nonprofits and an annual summer festival in St. Paul that celebrates Asian cultures across Minnesota. Eileen was 52. 74-year-old John Jack Delano Harding was a Renaissance man, his wife said. He had a passion for the outdoors, art, and theater, among other things. A family man, he loved to share his hobbies with his wife, kids, and grandkids. Above all else, Jack was drawn to science and all its possibilities. He loved discovery and collaboration. He dedicated himself to the field of molecular biology and went on to work at the National Institute of Health in Maryland, running its primate research center for almost 18 years. His wife said that breaking new ground that could better people's lives is what endeared Jack to his work. Simone Parker's favorite place was in the classroom, according to a close family friend. As a high school chemistry teacher in Trigg County, Kentucky, for the past 2 decades, Simone brought inspiration and encouragement to every one of her students, especially those who struggled. After Simone's passing, the school honored her with a painting and a plaque that included her usual saying to her students, quote, "Be good, be careful, come back to me tomorrow." Simone was 46 years old. Cole Brooks served his small town of Nowata, Oklahoma, as a paramedic for the last 8 years. Age 60, Cole was a humble man of faith, a cowboy through and through, who would help anyone he could, said his wife. The father of 2 beat cancer in 2018, then immediately went back to work on his ambulance crew. The Nowata Fire and Emergency Medical Services Department held a processional in Cole's honor after his passing, as his family brought him home for the last time. The Nowata Area Chamber of Commerce later named him Hero of the Year. Growing up in the Phoenix suburb of Tolleson, Arizona, shaped Hector Zaragoza's life. Hector became a hometown hero when in 1961, his predominantly Hispanic Little League baseball team won the Arizona State Championship. Hector went on to serve in Vietnam. After the war, he became a high school art teacher. A sensitive soul, he expressed everything through his art, said his family, and loved sharing art's healing nature with his students. A beloved father and brother, Hector saw beauty in everything around him, especially within his family. He was 71. Years ago Monday, a white mob descended on a black neighborhood of Tulsa, Oklahoma, killing many people and burning homes and businesses. The Tulsa Massacre is being remembered in many ways, one of them an art and history project. Jeffrey Brown has our report for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
A black man and white woman enter an elevator. This is a dance created by choreographer Ari Christopher in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 2021. But 100 years ago here, just such an encounter, a black man accused by a white woman of assaulting her in an elevator, a charge never tried or proven, led to one of the worst acts of racial violence in the nation's history. An out-of-control white mob killing up to 300 black people and destroying an area called Greenwood, a neighborhood so vibrant it was dubbed Black Wall Street. Part of the commemoration, the Greenwood Art Project, co-led by Houston-based artist Rick Lowe.
As I talked to the neighborhood folks, they all had such powerful stories that they were referencing about this history, and many of them through direct family relations. And that's what this project is all about. It's about taking those stories and contextualizing them in a way that people see the art in it.
Some of the results can be seen around Tulsa already. Installations of photos from the past, and one by contemporary Tulsa artist Crystal Campbell. Vibrant murals representing pillars of the historic community. A collage by Jimmy Friday in the Black Wall Street Liquid Lounge. A van being filled with art is taking visitors around the neighborhood.
Right now, we're on historic Greenwood. This was more of the business district that had more of the doctors, the lawyers.
Those riding along will see the work of professional artists, but also that of community members who are getting a chance to have their voices heard.
I come from a long line of survivors and a long line of people that make a way out of no way. That's what my grandmother used to say.
The Rez Anderson Aduni's film Rebuilding Black Wall Street was created from her father's old home movies and photographs. It's partly an homage to a man who loved his community, a businessman who captured it with his cameras.
I remember as a child opening up a closet door and all these cameras are falling out because every time a new one would come on the market, he'd get it. Him and my mom's biggest back and forth was about him spending money on equipment.
It's also a tribute to resilience and survival. Therese's father was of the generation that helped rebuild the neighborhood after the destruction.
At that time, it was about survival. It was about living the American dream as quietly as you can and not drawing attention to yourself so that it wouldn't be taken away.
In fact, what happened in Tulsa in 1921 was hidden away for many years after. City officials sought to erase the historical record. Black survivors, still living in fear for years after, often didn't discuss it with their own families. No one was ever held accountable, no compensation paid. There was no official record until a 2001 Oklahoma Commission report, previewed by news accounts, which is how Joy McCondishy first learned what happened to her grandmother and others. As part of the Greenwood Art Project, captured in this video about McCondishy, she's organizing a June 1st Century Walk, To replicate the flight by foot out of the city, many took to escape the terror.
A century walk is just a way to commemorate her by walking a mile in her shoes. That's just all it is too. It's not a protest, it's not a march. It's just a simple, quiet, memorable walk. And we're only doing 5.5 miles, but my grandmother walked over 60 some odd miles.
Artist Alexander Taman and architect Deborah Richards, both transplants to Tulsa, are taking another approach, connecting the past to contemporary Black entrepreneurs. They're building large terracotta blocks, a nod to Tulsa's Art Deco tradition, to enhance today's business spaces.
The history of Greenwood is one of resilience and also building and rebuilding over time because of what happened. And so we thought, how can we kind of build a workflow for this project for Tulsa that is about rebuilding and building and this kind of ceramics history?
A lot of the commemoration of the centennial is upon reflection and looking back, and we really wanted to be more forward thinking and more aligned with, I think, hope for the future and progress. This is a part of, my giving back, my not just, consuming, but really contributing.
Pakistani-born artist Sara Ekmad, who first came to Tulsa for an arts residency, offers a different kind of connection.
The shared histories of state-sponsored violence, oppression, massacres of communities, and side by side, the pictures look just exactly the same. So those connections, but also personal connections of personal history of trauma that my work is about, rooted in healing from trauma.
One event in the Greenwood Art Project was a recreation of a 1920s so-called Strutter's Ball, complete with period dress. Amid the fun and strutting, an imagined moment when people realized what was beginning to happen in the streets outside.
Hey! Cut the music! Cut the music! All hell's breaking loose on Greenwood! Y'all have to go home! Hug your families! Hide your valuables! What are you doing? Go!
Today, community members say Greenwood faces new challenges around gentrification and economic opportunities, and continuing issues that permeate all of society. Greenwood Art Project lead artist Rick Lowe.
Whether it's police brutality, whether it's gentrification, whether it's economic exclusion, all kinds of racial impacts that we need to be talking about. While the George Floyd issue kind of woke the nation up, the folks that we're working with in Tulsa, they've been living with this their entire lives.
Organizers hope this year's centennial commemoration honors the history, but also inspires action for the future. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
That anniversary coming up on Monday and Tuesday. And separately, we are excited to announce the launch of the first podcast from our Student Reporting Labs team, On Our Minds with Noah and Zion. We'll explore the biggest mental health challenges facing teens today. Please take a listen, subscribe, and engage with what you hear. You can find On Our Minds wherever you get your podcasts. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Thank you, and please stay safe over this Memorial Day weekend.